From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After being called the most liberal Republican in the Senate, after opposing the president on many votes, including the war in Iraq, and after getting high approval ratings from his constituents, Lincoln Chafee lost his seat to a Democrat last month. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Chafee about his years as a Republican senator from Rhode Island and what it was like to often go against his party. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers some of the contenders for Word of the Year. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Senator Lincoln Chafee, cleared out his office in the Senate building last week to make way for the new senator from Rhode Island, Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse. Theirs had been one of the most hotly contested races in the midterm elections. Chafee is a Republican, but many people wonder if he will remain one. National Journal had rated him the most liberal Republican in the Senate. He opposed President Bush on tax cuts, abortion, gay rights, stem cell research, and the John Bolton and Samuel Alito nominations. Chafee was the only Republican senator who voted against the war in Iraq. He didn't even vote for George W. Bush in 2004. Instead, he wrote in the name of the president's father, George H.W. Bush. Chafee served in the Senate since 1999 when he was appointed to replace his father, Senator John Chafee, who died of a heart attack. Lincoln Chafee, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me just start by asking you, did you expect to lose?
No, of course not. This was my, I believe, 10th run for office. I started out as a city councilman in my city of Warwick, and I did lose my first run for mayor of Warwick, and that back in 1990, I didn't expect to lose that. Very, very disappointed election night. This year in 2006, I knew I was in for a tough climb, and of course, the tracking polling was showing me closing the gap, but I knew I was in for a tough one, so I was prepared for both outcomes. But you have every fiber of your body dedicated to winning.
How are you dealing with the paradox of losing? And here's what I mean. I mean, you were considered the most liberal Republican in the Senate, and I think a lot of your constituents applauded you for what they saw as standing up to the Bush administration. Exit polls showed you had a 63% approval rating. But apparently a lot of people who approved of your opposition to the president ended up opposing the president by voting you out because they wanted to have a Democratic majority in the Senate. At least that's how your loss is being interpreted. So how are you dealing with that paradox?
Yes, well, I knew it was coming. And even back in November of 2004, they were asking, who are you going to vote for president? And I said, I'm going to write in President H.W. Bush. And I took a lot of criticism for that, but I could foresee my election coming up in 2006, 2 years later, and I wanted to inoculate myself as best I can from the entire George W. Bush agenda. But the satisfaction, I guess, or the solace is in that at least there were six states, and if the people of Rhode Island were going to vote me out on the premise that we need the Democrats, and they, from their point of view, wanted to get control of the Senate, they did accomplish that. It would have been more hurtful if the Republicans were still in control and many of my friends had voted against me because they wanted my Democratic friends because they wanted a Democratic Senate. And they didn't get that, and I'm out of a job both. So from that perspective, I guess there's some balm to the wounds.
Although you are a Republican, at least you still are for now, are you glad yourself that the Republicans have lost control of the House and the Senate?
Well, as we just talked about, I disagree so deeply with the George W. Bush agenda, the deep tax cuts, of course, the war that was built on a false premise of weapons of mass destruction, what's happening with our Supreme Court appointments. You can keep going. The environment, the executive powers, expansion of the executive powers, trampling on the Constitution in some cases, the Fourth Amendment of getting a warrant to tap into phone lines, bypassing that warrantless wiretappings. I mean, there's so much that I disagree with, but here in Rhode Island, my state, I'm very comfortable as a Republican. So there is a paradox, to answer your question. Ultimately, let's just hope the Democrats can steer this country in a balanced way against the president's agenda. That remains to be seen.
But you haven't really said yet whether you're pleased that the Republicans lost control of the House and Senate.
If you could read between my lines, between my words, I guess you could say yes. Yes, honestly, we need a check on this agenda. It's a radical agenda.
So now what? The speculation that you'll change parties, become a Democrat, and run again. What are your plans?
Well, the election's pretty much just over. I'm still just looking for employment and collecting my breath. As I said, I'm comfortable as a Republican here in Rhode Island. Trying to build a two-party system. We're very, very much the underdogs, as you can imagine, here in Rhode Island. And I enjoy that, trying to build a good two-party system here. So it depends on what I have in front of me. It's still too fresh after the election, really, to think about political plans.
And the next question is an obvious one. If you stay in politics, do you think you will stay as a Republican or become a Democrat?
I would pretty much rule out becoming a Democrat. And it just remains to be seen what might be ahead. As I said, if it's locally, I'm very comfortable being a Republican here in Rhode Island.
Why would you rule out becoming a Democrat? Some people would say that you're, you know, many of your votes are more liberal than a lot of Democrats' votes.
I guess the history of switching parties isn't that good. John Lindsay, remember him, mayor of New York City?
Sure do.
Switched to be a Democrat and really didn't go anywhere. Who else has switched? The track record isn't that good for switching parties. Maybe Ronald Reagan was successful at it, but way, way back in his career, he was a Democrat. But other than that, I can't think of anybody that's been successful switching parties. Some of the senators, but they just stay in the Senate. They don't move on anywhere.
Now, Roll Call called you the least powerful member of your party. So I don't know whether you agree with that or not, but if you do, what was it like to be the least powerful Republican in the Senate?
Well, that was just complete hooey. I mean, that premise, I think it was whoever put that rankings forward was based on how much you have in your political action committee. I'm one of the few Republicans without a political action committee. It's very, very difficult for me to raise money from my Republican donors because the Republican donors that like my stances have left the party. They don't contribute to Republicans anymore. Very, very hard to raise money in this past cycle that I ran in. And so that was, I believe, a big part of that ranking, how much money you have in your kitty or your political action committee. And so that ranking was erroneous. On the Environment and Public Works Committee, I stopped the rollback of the Clean Air Bill. On the Environment and Public Works Committee, just by virtue of my vote as a Republican, I stopped the rollback of the Endangered Species Act. On the Foreign Relations Committee, it was my vote that stopped John Bolton from going for another tenure at the United Nations. So I'd say you might argue I'm one of the more powerful Republicans, but just by virtue of my one vote.
And you saw your power as stopping things that your party wanted to do.
Yes, as the makeup of these committees are 11 to 9, I believe, and if I join all the Democrats, if they all stick, it's 10-10, and it doesn't come out of committee. Some people have said I'm the de facto chairman of these committees.
Now, what was your reaction to Republicans who called you a RINO, an acronym for Republican in name only?
Well, it depends on what your definition of a Republican is. And my definition is one that cares about fiscal responsibility, cares deep about it. That's what I consider a Republican. I consider a Republican someone that cares deeply about the environment and leaving a better planet for our future generations. Aversion to foreign entanglements. Doesn't that, Tony, sound like a Republican? We don't want to get involved in these entanglements around the globe. How about personal liberties? Isn't that a Republican virtue? We let people alone. And that's my definition of a Republican. And I'll argue that our party has been taken by the old Southern conservative Democrats. They've switched to being Republicans now, many of whom were Democrats. Trent Lott was a Democrat. That whole South, they were all Democrats. Now they've taken over our party and changed our agenda. And I also believe that government should use our tools to help the less advantaged. That's what I consider a Republican.
The Republicans are apparently really good at party discipline. What were some of the techniques that were used to try to get your vote?
The techniques are just the pressure of my colleagues to be part of the team, and oftentimes standing alone. For instance, on the war vote, the only Republican. There's certainly, as a member of any organization, you feel comfortable going with everybody else. That's just a natural human desire. And it's always difficult if you're the only one. And those committee votes I mentioned, we'd leave those committee meetings with my Republican colleagues just steaming at me. And I'd have to get in the elevator with my colleagues, and they were not happy. So that's difficult, and that's the pressure that you get, I would say. It's not we're threatening to take away some project in my state or run a primary against you. It wasn't that hard-edged.
No, one of your most talked about votes was when you voted against the resolution authorizing the war in Iraq. You were the only Republican in the Senate who voted against that. What was the reaction within your party to that vote?
Well, at the time, it was virulent, and especially back here in Rhode Island. I'd already voted against the tax cuts. That was the president's agenda on the tax cuts, one of only two, John McCain and I. And then now in the war, I mean, my Rhode Island Republicans, as small as we are, were absolutely apoplectic about it. And But I was absolutely convinced that the evidence of weapons and mass destruction were not solid. And I thought there was another agenda, and I said that before the war started. This isn't about weapons of mass destruction. This is about remaking the Middle East, and we're not having that debate. And I was proven to be right. If we're going to remake the Middle East, maybe it's a good idea, but let's talk about that before we go to war, and let's debate it and remove this ploy of weapons of mass destruction. I went out to the CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, just on my own, booked an appointment, and went out, and they had maybe 20 analysts there around a table showing me satellite pictures and the aluminum tubes that were supposed to be used for the centrifuging of uranium. And I just wasn't convinced. And more, Terry, than actual evidence presented to me, here I am, a senator that has to vote on this, on going to war. It's very, very important. I had some of the top CIA analysts there in that room. The body language of them, I didn't feel that they thought this evidence was solid. So not only was I looking at it saying, I'm not convinced, from what I got from those human beings at the table, also translated me, that the evidence just isn't there. And I went back and I talked to my colleagues. But the rush to war, the drumbeats of the terrorists are coming down Main Street was just too much.
Did it make it any more difficult or any easier for you to vote against the war, knowing that your vote was not a decisive vote?
No, this is going to war. I wish it were decisive. I was furious. We just got through Vietnam. We've just recovered from that long post-traumatic stress syndrome and veterans going through all the difficulties of returning from Vietnam. And the cost, never mind the human suffering, the high costs. And we're going right back in on flimsy premises. I was furious. In my Republican caucuses, I called it, this is insanity.
My guest is Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island. He lost his seat last month to Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Lincoln Chafee. He was considered the most liberal Republican in the Senate, and he lost his race in November and just left the Senate. Now, I believe you used to go out to lunch a lot with fellow moderates like Arlen Specter, Susan Collins, Olympia Snowe, Jim Jeffords. What would the lunches be like? Did you talk politics all the time?
Yes, and frankly, we would bemoan. I was there for the year of 2000, and then, of course, was elected in November of 2000, and we'd bemoan, and we'd meet every week, every Wednesday to have lunch, our status as moderates in the Republican Party that was drifting further and further to the right. And so when the elections occurred in November of 2000, all of a sudden it's 50-50. I think before that it was 55-45. I said to our group, we have the power. We can control the Senate. Us five, it's 50-50. The agenda comes through us. But for whatever reasons, we didn't hold. The five of us didn't hold. One by one, everybody went off on the tax cut, and that was the big one, supporting the big, deep tax cut, until it was just Jeffords left the party. It was me left, and then kind of surprisingly, Senator McCain joined me in voting against it. If we had held, I think that we could have made a statement, but we had to do it early on that first initiative.
What?
And I suppose the feeling was that here's the new president coming in. The first thing we're going to do is disrespect him, if you will. But it was worth it. I thought it was worth it. Let's show who's boss here.
Okay, so when this group of like high-powered senators gets together to talk politics at lunch, where do you go? I mean, do you choose a place where you won't be noticed? How could that be? Or a place where you won't be overheard?
It changed all frequently, Terry. Sometimes in each of our offices, we'd host, it was small enough that we could have a caterer come into our office, set up a table, and bring in the chicken and the mashed potatoes and the beans, whatever it might have been, and the salad. And sometimes we'd actually have it in the Senate dining room, mm-hmm. where we would be seen by everybody, and they'd all come over and make jokes and have fun. And Democrats would come over, stick to your guns. We need you voting with us on some issues. So it was always fun, though.
Now, as you've mentioned, you voted against the president's tax cuts. Was that a vote that you were particularly pressured on to vote the other way?
Absolutely. That was the big pressure, because the new president come in, and their modus operandi was to bludgeon recalcitrant senators into their support, whether Democrats or Republicans. Don't forget, they went after some Democrats in what we call red states, Democrats from Nebraska or Arkansas, some of these states, to try and get them to support this. And the vice president, in particular, Vice President Cheney, was the heavy on this. And but I stuck to my guns, and I said, I'd been there under President Clinton for a year, and he'd vetoed Republican spending bills of $400 billion. And I actually got his veto message and read it, saying, these are too deep. They're $400 billion. We were going for $1.5 trillion. The 0.5 was higher than what President Clinton had vetoed. And I went and got his veto message and read it to my colleagues. Why are we months later? I mean, he vetoed one in October of 2000. Here we are in the spring of 01, more than tripling spending that the previous president had vetoed. It's too deep.
Now, you said that Vice President Cheney was the heavy on the tax cut bill. So how did that affect you? Does that mean he called you personally?
Yes, asked to meet with me personally. And also, surprisingly, the Vice President of the United States called a radio talk show in Rhode Island. And next thing you know, the Steve Cash Show here in Rhode Island, WPRO, has the Vice President on the line saying that we need these tax cuts, we can afford them, the people need to get their money back, all that kind of rhetoric. So there was a number of ways the pressure was put on. Those are a couple.
So what was the impact of him making that statement on a Rhode Island talk show?
Well, it wasn't good for me. Certainly, it made it harder, but I had to make my arguments.
Well, how did it make it harder? Tell us what kind of impact that has and how that affects you.
It's mostly my supporters, the people that have supported my career, donated to me, that then are calling in and saying, wait a sec, the Vice President of the United States, the one of the leaders of our party, is taking the trouble to call into this radio show to get you to come on board with the team. And that's where the most pressure would come from, my loyal supporters that wanted me to be more part of the team. I'd have to make my arguments back, though, Terry, and that's what I'd have to argue with those people that would call me, saying, I'm willing to cut the taxes, but let's do it incrementally, and if we can afford them, we'll do more. I'm a politician. I love to cut taxes. That's the most popular thing a politician can do.
Let me give you another example of a position on which you were very out of step with your party, and that's on gay rights and gay marriage. I mean, at a time when the Republican Party was really mounting a campaign for a constitutional amendment to oppose gay marriage, you support gay marriage and support gay rights. Is that a recent position for you?
No, I just think it's my general philosophy of allowing people to have their personal liberties. And people are homosexuals. That's just a fact. And if you're going with homosexuals, want to join in a union and call it marriage, God bless them. And particularly on this issue, it was the states that were allowing gays to marry. And the constitutional amendment, if you can believe it, pushed by the Republicans, was to ban states from enacting their gay marriage law. mean, the Republican Party used to be states' rights, let the states make these decisions. Here we were switching to amend our sacred constitution to forbid states from enacting their own laws allowing gay marriage.
Now, a lot of people from outside the Republican Party said that the Republicans were using this anti-gay issue to rally the base. Did you see any evidence of that from within the party?
Oh, yes. That's been the agenda from the beginning. I mean, rally the base, just as you said. Energize the base. And just this past summer, leading up to these November elections, there was the constitutional amendment to ban states from enacting gay marriage, as we just talked about. There was also a constitutional amendment vote to ban flag burning. Now, when was the last time we saw a flag burned? 25 years ago? 30 years ago? But again, all the veterans groups revved up, and it was a one-vote margin in the Senate. Again, my vote was critical here, and we beat that back. And there was another vote, just this summer, to make felonies for minors that cross state lines to get an abortion. You know, a very divisive, emotional issue that for the party to spend our valuable time while we have a war, while we have all the troubles in this country on these issues was way off what I think the American people want us to be focusing on.
Senator Lincoln Chafee will be back in the second half of the show. He lost his seat to Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse last month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Windham Hill, presenting George Winston's new solo piano album, Gulf Coast Blues and Impressions, a hurricane relief benefit, available at Borders. And from Delacorte Press, publisher of The Lizard's Bite, a mystery set in Venice by David Hewson, author of The Sacred Cut. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, taking over his father's Senate seat, we continue our conversation with former Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers some contenders for Word of the Year. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island. He lost his seat last month to Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse. Chafee had been called the most liberal Republican in the Senate. He opposed his party on many votes, including the war in Iraq. Chafee came to the Senate in 1999 when he was appointed to replace his father, who died of a heart attack. The 109th Congress has been called a real do-nothing Congress. And I wonder what you think are some of the reasons for the lack of progress that the Congress was actually able to make.
I think that our biggest legacy is going to be, in my time there anyway, is going to be the virtual lockstep endorsement of the president's agenda. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly the Republicans controlled the House and the Senate except for that brief time when Senator Jeffords switched. But then 9/11 happened just weeks later, and the Democrats fell right in line with the drumbeat for war. And Congress just did not stand up and ask the questions about warrantless wiretappings, about environmental records, about the protection of the privacy that goes with Roe versus Wade, the privacy element of the Constitution. There's so much that we just did not stand up. The deep, deep tax cuts at a time when we'd fought so hard for surpluses. I think that's going to be our legacy. I just didn't have the will to stand up to this president.
You wrote an op-ed criticizing President Bush for not following through on his self-definition of being a uniter and not a divider. What are some of the ways you felt that he was a divisive force within the Congress?
Well, the very first action set the tone, and that was to repeal what they call the Mexico City Accord, which allows women on military bases to have information about all their reproductive choices. So right away, the very first, I think minutes within being sworn in, the statement was obvious. We're going to enact an agenda that is not in keeping with I'm a uniter. This is a highly emotional issue, even here in Rhode Island. People feel very, very strongly on both sides. And why, as your first act as new president, pick that issue to take action on? And that set the agenda. Then it was, we're getting out of all the international accords, whether it's Kyoto or International Criminal Court. And then it was $1.5 trillion tax cut and not a penny less. We're going to get our full tax cut. And it was radical. And it led to the desertion of our party of a good senator, Senator Jeffords from Vermont. He'd had enough.
Now, you were a part of a very major bipartisan effort within Congress, and I'm thinking specifically here of what was called the Gang of 14, and this was a group of 14 senators who created an alliance based on a compromise. The idea was that the Democrats wouldn't use the judicial filibuster except in extraordinary circumstances, and then the Republicans would prevent the Republican leadership from using the so-called nuclear option, which would have eliminated the ability to filibuster judicial appointments at all. Can you talk a little bit about your experience as part of this bipartisan group during a period that you saw as very divisive?
Yes, this was one of those great moments when, of all the difficulties and conflict we're having, Democrats and Republicans down there, and as we looked at the Supreme Court nominations, such critical choices the president's making, and the effort by the Republicans to take away the rights of the minority to filibuster, as you said, called the nuclear option. And the 14 of us got together. The group went up and down. Sometimes there were 8, 9, 10, sometimes 16. It ended up with 14 coming to this agreement. And I give Senator McCain a lot of credit. He really was the leader on this. And Senator DeWine, another outgoing senator from Ohio, and Senator Lindsey Graham showed a lot of courage coming from South Carolina. And he took a lot of heat on this to say, we need to give the president his executive powers to pick his people, but we want to protect the rights of the minority here in Congress, and that's what the agreement was successful at crafting. But it was great to be part of it. There were pro-life people, pro-choice people, there were women, there were men, there were veterans like Senator Byrd and Senator Warner, and newcomers like me and Senator Salazar from Colorado. It was a terrific group. We treasure our moments meeting, as we did frequently subsequently to the stopping the nuclear option.
Did that feel very exceptional to you, that alliance?
Yes, it did. It was exceptional for the times that I've been there, where there's such a partisan divide, and you're expected to be part of like World War One, where you're in your trenches and firing back and forth at each other, and no man's in between and barbed wire. I mean, that's pretty much the climate there. And so this was so good. And we'd get into whosever office we were meeting in with the agreement that what happened there would not be used against us. And that was very refreshing. You could say things candidly and not fear that half an hour later they'd be maybe misinterpreted and used against you on the Senate floor. That was refreshing.
My guest is Lincoln Chafee, and he was considered by many to be the most liberal Republican in the Senate. He was voted out in November and just left the Senate. Now, you voted against President George W. Bush in 2004, and instead you wrote in his father's name. That's a very strong statement to make, and you've said that you made it because you wanted to kind of inoculate yourself against what you knew would be a movement against President Bush. But at the same time, you still had to work with President Bush, even though you were often voting against him anyways. But what was it like to look President Bush in the eye after you made public that you voted against him and wrote in his father's name?
I think he respected that by writing in his father's name, it wasn't personal. It was, in other words, it's not against you personally. Your father's politics I could support. It's on the political agenda. And to be honest, I think he could respect that, and I will argue my points on whether it's the tax cuts or the war or the divisiveness of undoing Roe versus Wade. Is that good for our country? Is that what we want to do? The environmental laws that have served us well for so long, the declining strength of the middle class. I'll argue those with him any day.
Now, there's something you really have in common with President Bush, and that is that you each assumed the office that your father once held. His father was president, and your father had been a senator. Did you feel some kind of bond with the president because of that thing that you had in common?
Well, I knew President Bush, George W. Bush's brother Jeb, Governor Jeb Bush from Florida, very well. We went to the same boarding school together, but I didn't know George W. Bush at all. And I think he's very different. So there wasn't ever a real bond there, to be honest.
How well did you know Jeb?
Very well. We did some things together and had some fun, of course, at boarding school. And after that experience, we went in different directions. And I think the next time we saw each other, he was governor of Florida and I was senator from Rhode Island. And he was testifying on the Everglades before the Environment and Public Works Committee. And we had some laughs when he came in. He said, the first thing is statute of limitations is in effect here. We can't talk about all the bad things we did as youngsters.
Your father, John Chafee, was a senator, and he died in 1999 of a heart attack. You took over his seat. How would you compare your politics to his? And I'll say that in the New York Times, he was described as the soul of the Republican moderate faction.
I'd say pretty much a mirror image. He was just as I do, believed in personal liberties and strong environmental stewardship. He was when you frequently said, Terry, the most liberal member of the Republicans. But I consider myself very conservative with the taxpayers' money. I'm a former mayor, and so was my father. Tight with the government buck. That's his kind of republicanism. And using the tools of government to help the less advantaged. He was strong on that. So I think we mirrored each other. The only difference maybe was that having been mayor and having to work with my bargaining unions, my firefighters' unions, my teachers' unions, my police unions, the public works employees, the union, I was more maybe more parole labor than he might have been. Other than that, we pretty much a mirror.
It's just like reading about your background. It doesn't seem like you really planned to be in politics. I know you studied horseshoeing at Montana State University, and then you worked as a blacksmith at Harness Racetracks, which sounds kind of interesting. And then in 1985, you entered politics, and you were a delegate to the Rhode Island Constitutional Convention, then were in city council, then mayor of the city of Warwick in Rhode Island, and then, of course, senator. The racetrack and horseshoeing thing sounds like a completely different direction than politics.
Yes, you're right. I didn't think I'd go into politics. Those were, of course, the early mid-70s where people looking for adventures beyond out of the normal, going to work for a big company or an institution. That was the genre of the times. And I was fortunate. I was good with horses, and I had a good teacher at the horseshoe school, and I was successful working on the racetrack for as you said, about 8 years. And when I came back to Rhode Island after working around the country on different racetracks, I dabbled in politics a little bit and at the local level, and I enjoyed it. So I kept kept going on to the next level. And I lost my first run for mayor, but second time I made it and became the first Republican in 32 years in my city. And that was a great tenure. Every 2 years, though, difficult elections because it was a Democratic city. And then on to the Senate, and of course here with another setback in 2006. But I've enjoyed all of it.
You know, I'm just realizing that politics is so often compared to horse racing, and usually in a negative way. You know, oh, it's covered just like a horse race. So having actually been in the horse racing world, what are some of the good and bad comparisons that you see with politics?
Well, it is competitive, but at least in horse racing, there is a second place. You get some money if you finish second. As I well know right now, there's no silver medal. There's no second place money.
My guest is Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island. He lost his seat last month to Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Lincoln Chafee. He was considered the most liberal Republican in the Senate, and he just left the Senate after being voted out in November. You first entered the Senate replacing your father after your father died of a heart attack in 1999. That must have been a very emotional way to enter the Senate.
Oh, certainly. And I had my father announced that he was not running for his, would be fifth term. And so I had said, I'm going to run for it. So I was busy raising money. He had announced his retirement, and he was helping me raise money. And then he died, and we had a Republican governor, so I was appointed. But even though he'd been in the Senate all those years, I'd been off on the racetrack and doing different things. When I was sworn in, it was only the second time I'd ever been in the Capitol. I'd only visited him once and been to the Capitol. So I felt like a good rookie, lost, going down the corridors, not knowing which alleyway went where. And that was a good feeling. I wanted to feel the full experience of being a rookie.
When you replaced him in the Senate, did you often find yourself asking, what would my father have done with this vote?
Of course, yes. But being a tight family with lots of children growing up, I pretty much felt how he would vote, and I inherited some of his staff who I relied on greatly and would ask bluntly, how would my father have voted on this one? What would he think about this issue? And how did he vote when it came up maybe 15 years ago? And that was valuable.
You know, we've talked a little bit about being out of step with the Republican Party on some issues, and this is another example of you being really different than a lot of your fellow Republicans. You have said, correct me if I'm wrong, but you have actually said that you used cocaine and marijuana when you were young.
Yes, I knew the question was going to come up in campaigns, and I'm not one to sidestep it. I was honest. I said, yes, I had, but it's not healthy. It's not something that I'm proud of, and you want a healthy body. That's all we have, and don't abuse it.
And would you be willing to talk at all about why you tried them both?
It was the times, of course. I mean, and I'm sure I'm in the majority of that generation of people that tried various illegal substances. That's just, those were the times. Certainly the cocaine, I did not, this is honest also, I didn't like it. It just wasn't for me. Luckily, because this stuff can be addicting, and I'm glad that this new generation isn't as inclined to experiment with some of these illegal drugs, not only because it's bad for your health, but because the legal ramifications.
How come this revelation didn't kill your political career? How did you handle it?
Well, at the time I was running, as I mentioned, for the Senate, and Governor George W. Bush was running for the presidency. And remember when they were trying to get him to answer what they knew he had the alcohol, but they're asking about any other substance abuse or substances they might have tried. And he was saying, I think his line was, when I was young and irresponsible, I was young and irresponsible. And so it was in the news at the time, and I was going on a morning Sunday show in Rhode Island, and I knew that question was coming up, and I went back and forth, how am I going to answer? I know they're going to ask me. And I finally said, just be honest. And I think when they asked me, have you ever tried cocaine? Because I guess that's what they were asking Governor Bush at the time. I just said, yes, one word. And they were so shocked him that the interviewer didn't follow up too much.
And was there any follow-up afterwards at debates, or were you attacked because of it by your opponents?
Not so much. People gave me marks for honesty and not trying to dodge the question. And obviously, I'd at that stage in my life, I'd been successful as a councilman, as a horseshoer, as a mayor. I had a record that I could point to that certainly spoke to being able to make consistent good decisions.
So finally, I'll end with a question that we kind of talked about early on, but I just thought I'd revisit it. So what do you think the odds are that you will try to stay in politics?
It's still so fresh after the election. I still, you put so much energy into these campaigns. You just cannot imagine it. 7 days a week for the Senate and being one of the key races in the country. I knew Rhode Island was going to be the number one target of the Democrats. Obviously, we're the most Democratic state in the country. Raising money for 2 years. It's 7 days a week. I need time to recover from that.
Mm-hmm.
I gave it everything I had. We had a great group of people. There's so much energy and effort and intensity and focus on these campaigns. It's just all-consuming. Well, and I knew I was in for a tough one. I had the primary. At the high of winning the primary, and then the difficult stretch after that, fighting the agenda, which was toxic here in Rhode Island, with that R after my name, and then the disappointing returns of election night. So I need some time to breathe and get to know my children and wife again.
Was it hard to pack up and leave the Senate?
To be honest, I'm ready. I'm ready for a new adventure. I gave it my all. I have the great satisfaction of having done that. I think I acquitted myself well in my time in the Senate, certainly looking back at war vote in particular, and some of the things I was saying about I didn't believe there were weapons of mass destruction have proven accurate. I feel good.
Lincoln Chafee, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Senator Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island lost his seat to Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse last month. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the contenders for Word of the Year. This is Fresh Air. The end of the year brings with it not just 10 best lists for books and movies, but Word of the Year designations from professional societies and dictionaries. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has these thoughts on some of the contenders, including a couple of newsmaking racial epithets. We know these words are offensive, so we just want to let you know you are going to hear them during the discussion of why they were in the news.
The business of naming a Word of the Year began as a half-whimsical exercise in 1990. When the members of the American Dialect Society decided at their annual meeting to pick the word that best expressed some feature of the prevailing zeitgeist. Within a few years, the press was picking up on the vote as a cute end-of-the-year feature, and dictionary publishers and others began to get into the act with an eye to getting some free publicity. This year's winners are already trickling in. The Oxford American Dictionary chose the expression carbon neutral, and the linguist Dennis Barron picked roadside bomb at his Web of Language website. But while both those terms have been in the headlines, they aren't particularly interesting as words in themselves, no more than bird flu or polonium is. A better choice might be truthiness, which Merriam-Webster named as the 2006 word of the year on the basis of an online survey. The only problem is that that's the same word the American Dialect Society picked for 2005, and not even Stephen Colbert should get to win 2 years running for the same performance. Anyway, those are merely the Golden Globes and People's Choice Awards of lexicography. Serious wordinistas will be waiting for the linguistic Oscars when the American Dialect Society makes its selection in January. It's a strong field this year, what with contenders like Islamofascism, Netroots, Dwarf Planet, Buzzkill, and The Decider. Or if you're looking simply for bounce to the ounce, you'd probably pick Macaca, an item whose first and only appearance in American public discourse could be credited with tipping the Senate to the Democrats. Given the razor-thin margin in the Virginia Senate race, it's a fair bet that George Allen would have kept his seat if not for the flap when he used the word to refer to an Indian American at a campaign rally, and then try to explain it away as a term he'd made up on the spot without knowing what it meant. If that was so, it was certainly a bit of freakish bad luck that led him to tumble on a word that happens to be a racial slur in the North African French spoken by his mother. But in that case, maybe the nod for Word of the Year should go to another career-derailing racial slur which found its way via YouTube into the national spotlight. True, the career in question here wasn't nearly as high-flying as Allen's. Before his meltdown at L.A.'s Laugh Factory, people rarely referred to Michael Richards without adding, you know, the guy who played Kramer on Seinfeld. But that's just what made the uproar so notable from a linguistic point of view. Here's a B-list celebrity who lurches into an incoherent racist diatribe in the middle of a nightclub stand-up routine. And the next thing you know, he's all over the media and making the customary circuit of public contrition with Letterman and Jesse Jackson, delivering himself of the turgid self-analysis that betrays a life spent in acting classes. I was in a place of humiliation. I need to get into the depths of my being. It was as if Richards was the only person in America who didn't understand that nobody remotely cared what kind of place he was in when he went into his rampage. The whole business was simply a pretext for giving audiences another chance to watch the mesmerizing spectacle of somebody giving in to the rage that's implicit in that word.
He's a nigger! He's a nigger!
Oh, my God.
A nigger! Look, there's a nigger!
That woman's voice you hear pretty much sums up the first reaction of most people. Oh, my God. Of course, everybody knows the word, but nowadays most middle-class whites have suppressed it as a redneck vulgarity. So it was a shock to hear it yelled as a venomous insult, particularly by the endearingly rambunctious character who used to come crashing through Jerry's open door every week. No, we can't ban the word, but we can't easily pretend that we've gotten past it either. I'm not a racist, Richard said, with apparently genuine puzzlement. But that's the thing about that word. Whatever you think your intentions are, it trails its own history of hate and violence into the room. That's why Richard's outburst led some black comics like Paul Mooney to announce that they'd be dropping the word from their own material from now on. Of course, this particular epithet has been in the running for Word of the Year before. It could have been selected in 1998, when black leaders threatened to boycott Merriam-Webster for not beginning their dictionary definition of the word by labeling it as offensive. Or in 1995, when a tape of Detective Mark Furman using the word was played at the O.J. trial, reinforcing the jury's suspicion that the L.A. police might have planted evidence. Or if the linguists had been voting back then, the word could have been chosen in 1988, when the group N.W.A., or Niggas with Attitude, brought gangster rap into the musical mainstream with their album Straight Outta Compton, and set off an ongoing controversy over the use of the word by black entertainers. Or in 1948, when Strom Thurmond ran for president as a Dixiecrat and told his audience that not all the troops in the army could force Southerners to admit the nigger race into their theaters, swimming pools, and churches. Or in 1928, when Paul Robeson was criticized for singing the word in the lyrics to Old Man River in the Kern Hammerstein musical Showboat. Actually, that's why it's unlikely that anybody will choose the epithet as Word of the Year for 2006. The Richards episode may have been shocking, but it didn't really tell us anything we didn't know already. Still, you can be sure the word will be back in contention for the honor in years to come.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a tribute to the actor Peter Boyle. He died last night at the age of 71. Here's a classic Boyle moment from Mel Brooks' film Young Frankenstein, in which Boyle played the monster and sang this duet with Dr. Frankenstein, played by Gene Wilder.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes, or cutaway coat, perfect fits. Dressed up like a million-dollar trooper, trying mighty hard to look like Gary Cooper.
Cooper, Cooper!
Come, let's mix where Rockefellers walk with sticks or umbrellas in their mitts.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, in stores and online at bn.com. From Kay and Matthew Buxbaum, whose Buxbaum International Fellowship trains journalists for reporting from all over the world. Details are at npr.org. And from Capella University, an accredited university offering more than 20 doctoral specializations online at capella.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Iran just hosted a conference questioning whether the Holocaust really happened. On the next Fresh Air, how the Germans extended the Holocaust into Arab lands. We talk with Robert Satloff. His new book, Among the Righteous, is about Arabs who protected and helped Jews in Arab lands during World War II. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.